This is 16 to 1, a podcast about education, teaching, and learning. Hello.
We think we know a lot about education.
No. We don't.
Yes, we do.
We have a lot of opinions about education. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Better now.
So who are you? Can you introduce yourself and tell the listeners about yourself?
My name is Katie. I'm an English teacher at a high school in Southeastern Ohio. And I've been teaching for 6 years. I have a bachelor's and a master's both in English. And then I added on the education later. And my dad was a teacher for 30 years, but he taught reading and special ed and social studies. And so now my general interest was I wanted to be a history teacher, but my dad told me not to be, so I did the next best thing, which was English.
Sorry, I mean, English teachers everywhere.
No, it's not at English teachers. It's just that the likelihood of getting a teaching job in history is pretty
unlikely. The employability factor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. More people need English than history.
Okay.
Debatable, but they do.
Okay.
And if I could teach anything all year round, it would be Holocaust education.
Cool.
Tell me about yourself.
Yeah, I have nothing to do with education, technically speaking, right now. I am a web nerd and computer programmer. I came to this by means of a liberal arts degree from a really tiny college in Maryland. That I'm sure I will talk about in great depth later because I love it and you're rolling your eyes at me because you know how much I love it. I have a bachelor's and a master's. My master's in philosophy and education. And I worked in education nonprofit space for a couple of years before I got kind of disillusioned a little bit and kind of switched careers. But I maintain an interest in education and kind of hope to circle back around and combine my interest in technology and education eventually. So that's where we are now.
So we've decided that our superpowers combined would create a really interesting educational podcast.
An educational podcast about education.
Very loosely about education.
So we're going to cover all sorts of topics in this podcast. It's going to be about formal, informal education, our kind of some of our favorite subject matters, higher ed, compulsory education.
Anything we can wrap under,
really,
basically.
Anything that we can argue about for a little while, because we enjoy some friendly argumentation. The name of this podcast is 16 to 1, and that comes from...
It's the average student-teacher ratio in public schools in the U.S., according to the most recent Department of Ed numbers that we could find, except for I do not believe that number for a single
moment. I don't believe it either, but the Department of Ed says it's vaguely true as of, I think it was 2008 or something that we looked up. 16 to 1 seems very low to me, meaning it seems like there are very few students to teachers in that ratio.
Meaning I wish my numbers were 16
right.
to 1.
What is a approximate class size that you have for your sort of normal
for like
subject
college prep English 10? It's like 24 to 30.
Yeah. Know? See, that's kind of the range that I'm more familiar with in public school settings. So yeah, but I guess when you think about sort of rural schools... We just drove by a school yesterday that's very tiny and they're so small they can't maintain a high school football team because they have so few students enrolled. So
I guess if that's
if that's factoring into the average, that kind of thing. But
that frustrates me on my end.
Yes. Most of our teacher friends are underwater with class sizes, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in like tiny rooms. Like my room is tiny.
Tiny rooms.
To throw all of those hot
Stinky bodies.
Teenage bodies in the right after lunch or gym classes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to take a break just thinking about it because I'm not prepared.
Yeah. You go ahead and take a break. Okay. So, what are we talking about today?
We decided this week we're going to talk about the Oregon Trail because it's maybe my favorite and only memory of kindergarten.
Yeah.
And because I hadn't really had, like, a computer experience before that, even though my dad was a teacher, we didn't have a computer in the house until I was older, like, right. third or fourth grade. So getting to go to half-day kindergarten, and I got to play what I remember as a very black and green example of the Oregon Trail,
mm-hmm.
is still one of my favorite memories. And so now it's, like, popular again.
So really very early graphical interfaces on computers is what we're talking about here. We looked this up, and it was really, we both remember probably the Apple II port of this.
This is your part.
That
I'm going to check out now.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Don't say that. So we both remember the Apple II port, we think, because the Apple II was the computer that sort of started... Actually, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak's Apple empire sort of started with putting Apple II computers into big school districts and other things like that. It was sort of the computer that revolutionized home computing. We're talking about the Oregon Trail, the video game, but also the Oregon Trail, the actual Oregon Trail that the video game is based on.
So, Wikipedia and the National Park Service bring you this information directly from their websites, and I'm just going to briefly go through it because I think we all actually care more about the game that we know and love than the actual literal trail itself. Any questions?
No questions. Please proceed.
The Oregon Trail is over 2,000 miles long. I want to read it just like I would if I was reading to my students, but no one wants that. Okay, so
Hold on. Can you put on your teacher voice, please? Miss Katie, please read us.
Do not call me Miss Katie.
Miss Katie, read us some information about the Oregon Trail.
The actual trail itself was more than 2,000 miles long. It ran east to west, and it connected the Missouri River to the valleys in Oregon. So it started in what would become Kansas, and then, I know, I was thinking about driving through Kansas.
Brief interlude, Kansas is the worst state. I'm sorry for any of our listeners in Kansas, but that
I think
it's
we need
a place
to...
that should not exist.
No, I think we need to be kinder to Kansas.
Kansas was not kind to
there
my windshield.
There was a buffalo in Kansas.
There was one buffalo.
That's more than Colorado.
In all of Kansas, we saw it. Anyway.
Anyway, so Kansas is pretty forgettable as far as it goes, but it's part of this, which also explains why the Oregon Trail was truly miserable, was because they had
they
to
were
go
trailing through Kansas
on foot or on a wagon.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated it in a car that was air conditioned at 75 miles an hour.
Yeah, we had to be careful about our supplies and fuel.
We almost ran
on our Oregon Trail through Kansas. You can run out of gas in Kansas if you're not careful. Do not let your gas tank get below half because you might run out.
Kansas isn't a place I want to be with gas, let alone without gas. Okay, right. So it was through Kansas, what would become Kansas, and then also obviously Nebraska and Wyoming and Idaho and Oregon. In 1810, this guy, Robert Stewart of the Astorians, who were a group of fur traders, became the first white man to use what later became known as the Oregon Trail. His 2,000-mile journey took 10 months, and even at 10 months, it was still much less rugged than Lewis and Clark's, and it took that freaking long.
That's a long time.
So 1843 is one of the biggest ones. This migration was led by a former U.S. Army captain, and they had just under 1,000 people who made the journey. They ended up getting there just, I think, during October of that year, 1843, and he charged them each a dollar. So he was rolling in the dough. So yeah, that was like one of the big ones though.
Okay.
And that one got really, really popular, and that was like one of the biggest whole group travels, I guess we can call it, through all of Kansas, God forbid. And then finally, the biggest one, obviously, is the Gold Rush of 1848. It was 18-1 male to female, which is insane.
Ratio of travelers?
Yeah.
That's upsetting.
I mean,
I don't
really
want to be on that trail.
So roughly by the end of it, 112,000 males to 8,000 females.
Oh my.
And of
5,500
of them over the age of 15.
This is what we call a problematic
ratio. That's a lot.
Ratio.
So anyways, the Gold Rush went on, obviously being extremely successful. After 1849, it actually brought in more than $15 million worth of gold per year.
50 million.
That's what Wikipedia said.
Thank you, Wikipedia.
So go donate to them or don't donate if that's incorrect. But it says that it was $21 per ounce, which probably checks out. Mm-hmm. I would find that to be a reasonable amount in mm-hmm. 18 whatever. Mm-hmm. So part of the Oregon Trail was used even through like the Civil War. So like 1861, 1865. But then by that time we were starting to modernize finally trains and planes and automobiles, sans planes.
So I guess this is actually the real Oregon Trail, for whatever reason, is farther south than I thought that it was.
Well, until maybe it got to Oregon.
Yeah. Well, at what point does it get from Kansas all the way up yonder? Well, it only
cut through, like, a very small corner of Colorado, so it went north pretty quickly.
Mm.
Like, up through Idaho.
But they start in St. Louis, right?
Yeah, so they just keep cutting up. But St. Louis is, like, way over on the eastern side. So
interesting. It's not the most direct path.
Well, no, but they don't want to go through Nevada. And so there was a route. There was a route that some people took that would only save 7 days, but it took you through the desert for like 40 miles.
Okay.
And there was no way to have a fire, no fuel, like there was nothing. So that was one of the reasons why like that wasn't a very usable path, was because they didn't want to have to actually go through the desert.
Interesting.
So even traveling like through Nebraska, Wyoming, Idaho, and Oregon was safer than like through any portion of Nevada. So that's the actual Oregon Trail.
Hmm.
It feels like a lot. I'm so, not built for that sort of travel.
No. I don't think many people were. Hence this game's creation.
Gold talks, though. Like, that's...
Gold talks.
Well, people just wanted to get away from the British. Also,
they
wanted to
probably get their own land, right?
Well, that, and it got them away from, like, the politics of the East.
I remember that fort up there, Astoria. Is that what you said it was?
Mm-hmm. Or Astoria? The fur traders.
Yeah, we visited that when we got to that part of Oregon.
You did? I've never been to Oregon.
When I was a kitty. We went up there to Fort Astoria, and we got out, walked around. It was a bunch of logs, basically.
If you remnants of the trail.
No, the fort. The fort was but logs.
What I meant to say was that it seems that, I mean, a lot of these travels would have been similar, obviously, because they were taking the same route. The big group, that 1,000-person group called the Great Migration, they were one of the groups that used wagons to, like, their fullest extent and then would, like, float them. A lot of the things that I remember from the game is, like, part of the Great Migration journey, which is the 1843 people of, like, 1,000 people.
Okay.
So that part was really fun because I remembered that as, like, a kindergarten child, excited to not be in class. Okay, well, that's why the game, I guess, is important. So this leads into what you're going to be telling us about.
Yes. I'm going to be telling us about this crazy guy named...
Rowich.
Don Rowich. I had the hardest time trying to pronounce this guy's name. I just started calling him Don like we were old school buddies when I was
like
researching
when my students
this.
Call William Shakespeare Bill.
Yes, this is Bill, but instead his name is Don. Don Rowich?
Rowich.
I'm going to struggle.
You've got
just
it.
Just get used to it. Okay, so Don Rowich is the guy who gave birth to this incredible invention called the Oregon Trail, the video game that we all know and love from our early kindergarten years and beyond. So the game, just like everything you talked about, you assume the role of a wagon leader, and you go from Independence, Missouri to Oregon City in a covered wagon. 1847 is the date, I think, that the original game was set.
So before the gold.
It's before the gold. But probably around...
Oh, it's
a little,
right there.
Okay, so it's a little after the Great Migration time, but right before the gold rush. So everyone's heading out for golder pastures. Goldener pastures. gold...
Good try.
Gold pastures.
You were right there.
So...
And they all died on the farm. That's how it sounds. They went out for greener pastures.
Rip. So... In 1971, Don Rowich was a guy who was trying to figure out how to teach his kids everything that you just talked about and get them excited about a unit that was called, apparently...
Wow, that's hard.
The Western Expansion of the Mid-19th Century, which for 8th grade history class just sounds absolutely riveting.
Snooze.
He actually dressed up as Meriwether Lewis to try to get his class interested.
I like this guy.
He sounds really great, and I want to hang out with him. He sounds amazing. He still does educational technology consulting, and I just kind of want to call him up and chat. But yeah, so he dressed up as Meriwether Lewis, because what eighth grader doesn't like it when their student teacher dresses up as Meriwether Lewis? So he's trying really hard to get
it was the 70s, so yeah. It wasn't really that different.
This is true.
Looking,
he might have just fit in. This is what you put on when you go to class.
Like, he didn't change.
When you go to school, when you go hang out with your hippie friends, Meriwether Lewis regalia. Anyway, so he is trying to get his students interested in this concept that some of us might find less than riveting. And he originally had this idea to make a board game to teach, essentially, the Oregon Trail, the journeys to the West. And he had a couple of friends who were also student teachers at the time, Paul Dillenberger and Bill Heinemann. These guys suggested that he try one of these fancy new computer options instead of a board game. So they used what is just an absolute ridiculous thing to read now, but HP Timeshare Basic, which is a basic programming language interpreter, running on an HP 2100 mini computer to write a program to teach the subject. So to get an idea of how these...
Read your next line of notes.
Yes, these computers are old AF. they're nothing. This interface would be nothing like what you and I are used to right now. We're sitting here with our laptops on our laps as we read these notes for these shows. These computers, they required a teletype or a teleprinter, which is like these weird kind of things that look like typewriters that connect through a phone line to a mainframe computer, which is the size of probably the room we're sitting in right now. They're huge. I can't imagine interacting on a computer like that, but the way the students would eventually play the game is huddling around this weird little typewriter thing, and it would spit out printed results from a computer program that ran on the mainframe. So anyway,
The school already had this computer?
The school had the mainframe, like the big computer, and they had a teletype in the classroom.
Okay, so he just kind of built it around what he... Okay.
Yeah, he and his friends...
I just didn't know if it was like his that he like
They programmed
in.
It. He and the two guys, the friends, they like sat... I think they sat in like a janitor's closet, basically. Mm-hmm. It was like converted to sort of house the computer, I think. Something like that. It was very locked in a closet programming kind of nerd,
so
nerdy
like,
days.
Probably very limited sort of access.
Well,
to...
it was very limited. When they ended up printing the source code for this thing, it was 800 lines of code, which I might write 800 lines of code in like a week or so, depending on what I'm working on any given day.
It's not a lot.
It's not a lot by today's standards. It is not necessarily a lot, but also people write way more code than they need to today. You could simplify. Anyway, it's a fun chunk of code that they...
but it took them how long for 800 lines?
Okay, so the original game, they...
Like, if you can do that in a week, like, what are they?
They wrote the original game in 2 weeks.
Oh.
They planned out...
I guess you need to work harder.
I know, I need to work harder. How about that?
Sorry.
It's kind of amazing. So these guys set up the original program in 2 weeks. They coded it in their little janitor's closet, and they kind of stayed up late at night and acted like the early times computer nerds that we love to see and depicted in movies and very Steve Jobsy of them. And they weren't so Don Rowich.
Don,
my friend Don. So Don didn't know how his students were going to react to this, because most of them had very little exposure to computers before now.
Well, I was going to say, I had very low exposure when I played it in 1995.
Yes.
And that was in, like, when computers were much more mainstream.
They were very new. I remember when our school got classroom computers, and it was a really big deal. Not every classroom had that.
I've told you about that.
Yeah, we moved from classroom to classroom in my school. We would all go to the room with the computers in it, because we did not all have computers all the time when they first became popular. They were pretty quickly adopted, though, I think, between probably second, third, fourth grade, somewhere in there.
I only remember them in the classroom in third grade, and that was when all I could figure out how to do was to go to the NASA webpage.
The NASA website,
so
yes.
All I did, that was the year John Glenn went back up into space, and so all I did was read about him, so I grew, like, a weird, you know, fascination with NASA.
Yes.
But only because I didn't know there were other websites.
There are only 5 websites.
And it was just NASA.
NASA.
The government only let me on NASA.
eBay.
I couldn't get to that in third grade.
Oh, third grade.
I can't remember, maybe Newsweek. It was probably like Newsweek NASA? For kids or like Newsweek. Time for Kids or something. Yeah. But literally all I could figure out how to get into the computer was NASA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were very regimented with what. And I also don't really think the teachers understood what horror they were creating by granting us access to the World Wide Web. They were just like, here you go. Here's an internet browser.
Well, they were safe with me.
Well, we didn't. Yeah, that's the thing. They didn't. With you.
My third grade teacher was like, great. She's just on NASA
again. She's on NASA again. And she's on NASA again.
Katie gets like 10 minutes a day still on NASA.
This is, to this day, the only website Katie knows of.
My homepage is NASA.
NASA.gov. It's the best and only website on the World Wide Web. So anyway, we both remember the early days. No Space Force. Please no. So anyway, this was the early days of computer. This guy did not know how his students were going to react, but they absolutely loved it. They made up excuses to stay after school and play it, and everyone loved it. They started to, like, so they had limited time because they all had to huddle around this weird teletype thing, so they started voting about who was gonna, you know, put in. They basically created a little democracy to choose what they were going to do, because the game had, you know, all these different variables, and based on how much, you know, food you had and ammo and all these kinds of things. So they would vote on what they were going to do, and it kind of created these little mini democracies in their classroom. So it was a real hit. At the end of that term, he printed out the copies of the source code. Like I said, there's 800 lines of code, and then he deleted the program from the mainframe because they didn't really have use for it anymore because he was a student teaching.
Oh, I thought it got deleted, no. He did it.
He deleted it.
Can I just say, though, that as a teacher, anytime that I'm like, this is the greatest thing I've ever created, it's never liked. And anything that I, like, create on, like, the fly is, like, their favorite thing. So for him to have put all of this work into something and then actually enjoy it, that's what I'm jealous of.
Yeah.
Not the success.
I think it really helps that it was so weird and innovative at the time.
Yeah, I love that.
It's still a little bit thrown together in terms of how computer stuff works, because, like, they definitely didn't have a very perfect functional computer program.
Right, I'm just saying, like,
but it is
never
amazing.
Does it ever happen in your classroom where something's, like, really, really well scripted and they're like, this is the best thing ever. Mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. like the last minute thing that I just found that day that they're like, wow, this was the best thing
we've
done.
Students embrace chaos.
They do. So do I.
Yeah. So the sort of rest of the history of the game, it was picked up by the Minnesota Educational Computing Consortium. I don't know if I mentioned, but this guy teaches in Minnesota. He was a senior at Carleton College at the time when he was doing this student teaching. So it was picked up by MECC. He kind of had some weird entry-level job in 1974. That's when he was hired, and he spent Thanksgiving weekend of that year kind of recoding the original game. He reprinted out that basic source code, and he kind of typed it all back into the system and then edited it based on a lot of research that he did subsequently, because he didn't have a whole lot of time to be super accurate, but he ended up looking at journals and all kinds of...
Well, and probably then he needed to be like, if this is being picked up to go to, like, a wider audience, I need to make sure I've got the right facts, really.
So he did more research. He tweaked all of the probabilities in the game. A kind of problematic thing that he tried to fix was more positive depictions of Native Americans in the game, because their original game I read was kind of based on Westerns, like movies, rather than actual human behavior, which is problematic for any number of reasons. So,
oh, you mean we don't always tell it just like it is?
We don't always depict history
accurately.
Successfully.
Yeah. Fair.
In film, on television. So anyway, he made a lot of changes, and then he just kind of slapped this thing onto this MECC's network in 1975, and then it could be accessed by schools all across Minnesota.
Okay.
So it went through a bunch more iterations. It was very, very popular among schools. It started getting distributed, like, hit the big time when the Apple II computer was released. That's, they, MECC made a fully graphical version of the game for Apple II computers.
Which is not the one that we played.
I think that we played an even later version, but I'm not sure. I'm really not sure, because I think I remember some Apple II computers somewhere.
I really remember it just being black and green.
Well, yeah.
Like, screen-wise. I don't remember there being, like, Knox, like, an actual, like, graphic.
I'm really not sure. Okay. But we should look up in 1985, because in 1985 we weren't on the fully graphical in the way that you were thinking of. A fully graphical version just means it's, like, there's actual, like, you can look at a screen.
Oh, well, then I guess technically it was fully graphical.
It might have been this version. We haven't decided which one. That one was redesigned by R. Philip Bouchard. So they kind of were targeting home consumers at that point. So it's gone through a million iterations. Okay. There are even more after that. There's still versions of the game out today. It's sold more than 65 million copies. Oh, probably way more than that by now, because this stat is a little bit outdated. But so the guys who originally developed it, their roommates, Don Rowich and Rowich, his two job. Programmer friends.
Don, thank you.
Yeah, they're kind of, they're basically just educators who happen to be gifted in this particular early era of computer programming. And despite the fact that this has been sold so many millions of times, these guys kind of really never.
Teachers don't expect to make money.
So they're teachers. They did it for
we
the
don't
love
make money.
Of teaching mid 19th century expansion, Western expansion. They didn't do it to make any money off
of it. But man, some money would have been
copies.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Some of it would have been nice to have been shared with the teachers who actually created the game, but they kind of never really got the credit or the reimbursement they deserve from it, but no. They seem to be okay with it in interviews that I've read and stuff.
Oh, that's
so
polite of them.
Yeah, it is. They are very polite gentlemen. So it's, you know, it's obviously a game that you and I know about. It's a game that many people our age know about.
Well, it's come back.
It has come back in many a format.
Like, my students know about it. Like, yeah. They talk about it fondly.
There's a Facebook version of it. There's, like, an
is there?
iPhone
We're
version.
We're thinking about the one I bought you.
Yes, I have a handheld version of it. My mom had some surgery this spring, and I got, as a gift from Katie, a very beautiful handheld version of the Oregon Trail.
And it makes the most beautiful music.
It makes really beautiful kind of early computing era noises that I wouldn't call music.
Oh,
exactly.
I think it's nice.
It sounds like maybe 16-bit. It's really fun.
But
it's
it works.
Fun little noisy sounds, and it's a real recreation of the Oregon Trail game that we played with the
that's what it looked like
the
in
black
my head.
And gray
yeah.
graphical and the weird little shooting interactive game, like the hunting interactive mm-hmm. game. Mm-hmm. That was a sort of later
and Chelsea
edition.
Has always survived that version, and
I
every
survived.
Time I have played I have died, and I also broke my arm in a river, which was never explained to me.
Well,
but I didn't die of dysentery.
I think the wagon fell on you. Yeah, so when you hear that phrase, you have died of dysentery, listeners, we all know that that is actually from a slightly later version of the Oregon Trail. That was not in the original one, from what I read, but it is from the Oregon Trail that we all know and love. The franchise.
The franchise.
The Oregon Trail franchise.
But they made no
the
money
Oregon
off
Trail
of.
Universe.
Don, thank you. Kindergarten
Don
Katie, thank you.
Rowich.
Truly.
You are a hero and a champion.
We used to fight over that game because we only had one computer for all of the kindergartners.
You guys didn't create a mini democracy and vote?
No.
Oh.
We just, like, fought for the chair.
We just fought.
And then we'd pull the power cord, whatever, things, you know.
That's rude. And also can corrupt your file system.
I'll tell Kindergarten Katie that, too.
Listeners, do not pull your computer power cord. Okay. So we're going to go ahead and
we're going to end.
So we're going to go ahead and wrap up,
this
I believe.
This is it. Goodbye.
This is the way we are departing. We're going to try to end on a note of something that we learned in the past week, because mm-hmm. it is an education podcast.
So what did you learn this week?
So I learned...
I'm upset.
Oh, this is upsetting. I learned about brownouts. Which sounds nastier than it is, but it's still kind of nasty. It's the thing that happens when you lose power, but only kind of. And basically it turns your whole house into the Disney Haunted Mansion ride, because all the lights flicker. All your appliances kind of keep turning on and off like they're haunted. Your sump pump alarm will start going wee-wee.
Which is the worst sound of life.
It's really creepy at 3 a.m. especially. Mm-hmm. So there was a big, big storm here in central Ohio, and there were a bunch of tree limbs down everywhere, and people had holes in their roofs and things bashed in and trees falling on cars all around us. Our house luckily did not take any damage, but we did halfway lose power because there was probably a...
Which was sort of more frustrating than just losing power.
Yeah.
Because we were constantly in between it. But then also, what I think is maybe the most important thing that I learned also from this, I'm not going to piggyback on yours, but like you're always at a really high risk for a surge issue.
Yes.
So even though we had power, we couldn't actually use anything.
We unplugged everything that was in risk of being fried by a surge. So we unplugged all of our TVs and
no
gaming systems. We turned off the AC. We actually left the refrigerator plugged in because we just wanted to risk it, I guess, to keep our food cold. But we unplugged pretty much everything else. We didn't charge our phones. But the thing that I thought was very interesting that I learned was that if you have smart light bulbs, we have a bunch of Hue light bulbs in our house. And if you have smart light bulbs and there is a brownout or a lowered voltage going to the light bulbs, they will flicker like a strobe light.
Yeah.
We got a call from a concerned friend saying, "Are you home? Your house is dancing," basically. It looked like we were having a dance party in our house because our smart lights were just flickering rapidly.
So we had to leave.
We had to leave
a time in Hollywood.
We did not get to see...
Don't tell me the ending.
Leo DiCaprio's ending. Listeners, please do not tell us the ending of that movie because we're going to go back and see
it. I'm going to get there.
So yeah, that's all, everything I learned about power brownouts. Oh, I also fixed the dryer again.
Okay, well, I learned, or sort of just expanded maybe my knowledge. I don't know why this is knowledge that I found useful. Basically, my Rolodex, if you will, of knowledge is things I really don't actually need, like, ever. So Chelsea and I play trivia weekly at a local place, and this week one of the questions was about the Assateague and Chincoteague ponies, in which two states share the responsibility of the Assateague ponies. And I knew that Chincoteague was in Virginia, and
I
had
not
just read that Assateague was in Maryland because I just watched a Facebook video of those ponies in the surf, like just living their best lives.
Yeah, I live in Maryland, and I did not know this.
So I sat at trivia and was like, I know it's Maryland, and I guessed Virginia because that's where Chincoteague is. I've never been to either of these places, but I have a real interest in anywhere with, like, free roaming ponies and horses.
Ocean ponies.
Ocean ponies, if you will. But not seahorses.
Okay, wait.
That was
stop
a good
that. Stop it.
Anyways, if you're curious, Assateague shares.
Chincoteague ponies, Assateague horses, right?
Does that make you feel better?
Well, but ponies and horses are not the same thing.
But they're, like,
seahorses.
Synonymous.
Got it. Moving on.
They share the same name. Ponies and horses are basically the same thing, unless you're literally talking about a pony. And then those are like the little ones.
Like little Sebastian.
No, he's a different... Do not bring him into this.
He's a pony.
Okay, he's a miniature pony.
Anyway, your turn.
Next week, I'm going to learn what the difference between a pony and a horse is.
Okay.
Anyways, for anyone keeping track at home, Assateague is shared between Maryland and
Virginia.
Virginia, not Delaware.
No, I thought it was Delaware, even though I live probably about an hour away from these places.
It's fine. I knew it, but I couldn't have been right.
I am very sorry, fellow residents of Maryland.
Also,
Watson is sorry as well. I am sorry, residents of Maryland, that I did not know where Assateague and Chincoteague.
So anyways, I guess if you want to go see some seahorses, if you will, Assateague and Chincoteague. I hope they hire me to do their tourism stuff.